Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, January 17th, 2010. Our guest today is going to be someone who's just written a book about the person whose theme music you're listening to in the background and whose theme music has adorned this program since we began in 2002. We'll be talking about Thelonious Monk with Robin Kelly. But first, before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
2 centuries after the founders wrote about the necessity of a free press for the survival of a democratic republic, the American news media appear to be in trouble. As newsrooms and foreign bureaus shrink and disappear, the debate about the crisis in journalism has shifted from a blame game to generating ideas for ensuring the survival of investigative reporting. Professor Robert W. McChesney and journalist John Nichols have been vocal participants in this debate. They've written a new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism. An excerpt is in the latest issue of The Nation magazine, which clears up long-held misconceptions about the production of news and discusses new ideas for a vibrant American media that supports good journalism.
McChesney, who teaches at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is the author of numerous books on media and politics and is the co-founder of Free Press. He says that the 100-year-old idea of getting journalism from newspapers that serve as profit-maximizing vehicles fueled by advertising has run its course.
One of the great misconceptions that really damages our ability to grasp the crisis of journalism and what to do about it is the belief that it's naturally a free market function set up to maximize profit based on getting revenues from advertising. In fact, this model is a relatively recent historical development. Advertising came to play the dominant role providing revenues to bankroll journalism in the late 19th century and has done so for a century. But now that model has ended, and we have to look at the fact that that wasn't really the rule of thumb. That was the exception to the rule. Before advertising had emerged to take over the sponsorship of journalism, it had been a heavily subsidized matter by the federal government through postal and printing subsidies, because they understood, the founders did, and the Congresses and the government first 100 years of the United States, that unless there were massive public subsidies, the public good that is journalism wouldn't have been produced sufficiently by the market, nowhere near sufficient.
That's the moment we're in now, McChesney says, the realization that if the existing market is not producing good journalism, we need to look elsewhere, starting by looking at our own history, for ways to subsidize the news we need.
In the first several generations of the Republic, the federal government instituted massive postal subsidies. And this was crucial because almost all newspapers and magazines were distributed by the mail. That was the distribution system of America's free press. And the subsidies were extraordinary. To send a newspaper cost just a small pittance during this period. You know, the big debate in Congress throughout this period was whether to have a very small charge for newspapers or to let them all be sent for free.
At the time, subsidies for news actually accounted for a large part of the federal budget.
By our calculation, if you took the same percentage of gross domestic product today and dedicated it to journalism subsidies as the government of the United States did in the first half of the 19th century, it would be approximately $30 billion, $30 billion subsidy. That's how crucial supporting a free press was to the American government prior to the late 19th century.
Government spending for subsidizing a free press was only second to military spending back then, McChesney says. Yet today, we spend only $400 million in public funds for all of public broadcasting, not just journalism. That's a mere pittance compared to other countries in Western Europe and Asia. These countries heavily subsidize their public broadcasting systems and their newspapers.
What the record shows us from Western Europe is that these countries also are regarded as strongest democracies, the least amount of government corruption, the most amount of public involvement in political life. They also, by the calculations of Freedom House, which is a very pro-private, pro-commercial media organization, have the least amount of government harassment of private commercial media.
McChesney argues that although successful commercial media models are welcome, we need public subsidies as the foundation of a strong, independent, nonprofit, non-commercial media.
So in the short term, in the crisis phase, the most important thing we need to do is really heavily bankroll our existing public and community stations to have them ramp up their journalism, particularly at the local level. Down the road, we have to think about ways and policies to get young people back into journalism. We're losing an entire generation. And we have to ultimately think about ways of creatively funding digital news operations that haven't even begun yet, that we can't even imagine. So they have the resources to do the job, and they don't have to beg for micropayments and advertising, but they can do the job of journalism.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to have a sort of a treat to myself, if I may be so indulgent in today's program, because we're going to be talking about the composer and the musician whose music has been the theme music for this program for Media Matters for 7 or 8 years, and the author of the definitive biography of that gentleman, Thelonious Monk. And before we go to our guest, a little bit of an anecdote. When this program began in 2002, I said to my producer then, Ben Scott, we need some theme music. And he said, well, what should I get? And I said, basically anything by Thelonious Monk. And he said, well, you mean, isn't there a cut you want? Isn't there a particular version of a cut that you really prefer? And I said, no, with Monk, basically you can just stick your hand in the water and whatever you come up with will be brilliant. I really had no qualms and let him pick so. And in preparation for this week's program, I've had a chance to listen to virtually the entire catalog of Monk's music, and I think I stand by that assessment that I made 8 years ago. So with that introduction, allow me to introduce our guest today. Joining us on the phone, Robin Kelly is a professor of history and American studies at the University of Southern California. His books include Race Rebels, Culture, Politics, and the Black Working Class, and Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination. He's written on music and politics for a wide range of publications. He's a very well-known scholar. In his new book, what we'll be talking about today, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, just published by Free Press to much acclaim. Robin Kelly, thank you for joining us today on Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me.
First of all, let me ask you, this is an extraordinarily rich and deep book. How much labor is going into this book?
Well, altogether, I put about 14 years into it. Now, 14 years, not continuous, but it took at least 5 years to convince the Monk family to give me access. And once that happened, it just opened up, you know, so many vistas for me. I mean, they have quite a rich load of very specific materials that help me. But the most important thing was having access to the people, to the family, to folks who would never speak to interviewers before. And that really made this happen for me.
And, you know, I confess, Robin, I have always liked Monk's music and listened to it for, dating myself now, 35 years fairly religiously. And I knew so little about Monk. When I started reading your book, it occurred to me that here was this sort of giant figure of American music and culture. And I had, and I think I emailed you to that effect, just really not understood the richness of his path to his music until I read this book. And I assume that probably a lot of people didn't know this path either.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. It's also appropriate to be on your show talking about Media Matters because in some ways, Monk was an invention of the press. And you know, going back to at least 1947, 48, some of his early press releases from Blue Note Records that described him as a mysterious, you know, taciturn, strange figure, and that very mysterious quality was part of the selling point for his music. You know, so he's an unknowable person, or the anecdotes, some of which are true, but the anecdotes about him wandering around late at night looking for a piano, not sleeping for days. This sort of overwhelmed what other biographical information might be out there. Monk also was very protective. I mean, he wasn't one who gave a lot of interviews, nor was he one who gave a lot of information. I think he kind of reveled in that that kind of mysterious veneer, and it worked for him to a point, but then it started to sort of, it was like a backlash against him when it came to getting gigs and working. His reputation for being unreliable made it even more difficult for him to find work. So I think that part of the problem is trying to dig through that veneer and get at the truth. And, you know, it's funny because when I first conceived of the book, I was interested in the veneer. I was interested in writing a book about representations of Monk, but it's not as interesting as his story. And I do think there's a direct link between the music he makes, the titles of his compositions, the path he took musically, and the nature of his life.
Our guest, Robin Kelly, author of the new book, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. I know many of our listeners are familiar with Monk's work. Some, I'm sure, are not. And I'm reminded of a passage you had in the book from his dear friend, the Baroness Panonica de Königswörter, otherwise known as Nika, where she wrote the liner notes for one of his albums. And she said, if you've heard his music, no words are necessary. If you haven't heard, listen. And I thought that really was probably the best liner notes I've ever seen for Monk.
Oh, yeah. The original ones are about five times longer. I mean, the original draft, which I found in the paper, Columbia Records papers of Teal Macero, the draft was about four pages. And I wish I could have made a color photocopy of those notes because, you know, she uses colored pencils. It looks like some surrealist writing, you know, underlined and stars and all this mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, to be able to reproduce that even gives you an even richer sense of how thrilled she was and how moved she was by his music.
Yeah, I want to talk about Panonica, also the subject of two of his best songs, at least two that I've came up with out of the book that I'm familiar with. Three, actually, Coming on the Hudson, I take that back. Mm. At least three of his best songs inspired by Panonica. But before we do, I think we should play a cut to give some of our listeners a sense of Monk's music. And we're restricted by what we were able to get out of the Will Library on very short notice. So this is not, we asked Robin Kelly to give us several choices, none of which we were able to locate, unfortunately. But nonetheless, the first cut we're going to play is Trinkle Tinkle. Robin, what can you tell our listeners who might not be familiar with Monk what to expect here? When was this recorded?
Sure. This is recorded in 1957. This is John Coltrane on saxophone. John Coltrane had joined Monk's band when he played at the famous Five Spot Cafe downtown. The drummer, Shadow Wilson, and the bass player, Wilbur Ware. And the song itself was recorded about 5 years earlier, and it is a song, the title Trinkle Tinkle really is a tribute to these old-style 1920 stride pianists who had this amazing finger facility.
And what do you mean by stride piano? Because I think that's a term you use in the book, and probably I suspect a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with
it. Yeah, stride piano is, imagine like old-time piano players who were unaccompanied, and they'd play a bass note and a chord, back and forth, like a seesaw, on the left hand, and the right hand is doing all these amazing things. So you think of a person like Fats Waller, who, you know, even if you never heard his music, you sort of get a sense of who he is. Jelly Roll Morton, these are the old stride pianists. And I kind of argue that Monk comes out of that old-time piano playing. And so Trinkle Tinkle, in some ways, is a tribute to those pianists and to that style, because they used to call them ticklers or tinklers. And so here you have John Coltrane playing a melody that really is written for a piano. That's a very intricate, difficult melody. And he, as we say in the vernacular, he tears it up. It's just beautiful.
Well, let's go now then to Trinkle Tinkle, the Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane Quartet, the Monk Quartet, 1957.
Thank you.
Robin Kelly, that was Trinkle Tinkle from the Monk Quartet. And, you know, Robin Kelly, you wrote this book, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, just out, and it's really the definitive work. You know, what you've listened to all his music over and over, you're a musician yourself. I mean, what is it about Monk's music, if, in a nutshell, if you could, that is so unique? I mean, I'm striking to find the right words to describe it.
Right, right. Well, you know, a couple things. One is just in terms of the melodies, you know, listening to that song, no one was writing melodies like that. Very modern, very angular. And what we mean by angular is that it's like the tones leap, you know, cross intervals, you know. These are not songs that you typically walk around the street humming, although it's not impossible, you know. The other thing is that Monk, unlike his contemporaries, created a whole new architecture for his music. In those days, especially in the days of bebop, a lot of artists would take an old Tin Pan Alley song like, you know, What Is This Thing Called Love, or All the Things You Are, or the, you know, some Gershwin song, and they would write new melodies over the chords, over the chord progressions. Mm-hmm. What Monk said was, look, I don't need to do that. I'm going to make something completely new and fresh. And so his harmonic conception was so different from his contemporaries. That's why, in some ways, Monk is his own school. I hesitate to kind of throw him in with other artists, like, you know, yet another Dizzy Gillespie or Charlie Parker. He had his own kind of creative vision for his music. And I think the final thing is that he was someone who took the old traditions of the 20s and 30s, the music he grew up listening to, with a kind of very modernistic take. And so, again, to go back to Trinkle Tinkle, he may have elements of kind of piano trickery, which we associate with the 1920s pianist, but it's not stride piano at all. It's very, very modern. It's almost otherworldly, you know, in terms of its musical conception. And then Monk just, he could swing, you know, and there's something that it may not always be, may not always have that kind of melodic sense that you could sing all the time, but you're certainly bobbing your head, you know, and it's music that is very, very compelling. That's not to say that he didn't have detractors, people said he couldn't play. But when you grab onto Monk, I think you're absolutely right. You can dig into the well and grab any of the songs, and there's something compelling about every single one of his compositions.
One thing, Robin Kelly, that's interesting is that it's in some ways a lot of the music's very simple, but at the same time it's extraordinarily difficult. And one of the things that comes out of your book is the difficulty Monk has getting sidemen who can master his material.
Right.
And, you know, it was sort of a surprise because it sounds like Monk probably had more difficulty than almost any other jazz leader of the 50s or 60s.
Yeah, that's very true. And part of the problem was a couple problems. One, coming up in the post-war period when the artists he loved the most became leaders. You know, like Sonny Rollins had a mastery over Monk's music. He was a saxophone player, and Monk always wanted Sonny Rollins in his band. But, you know, Sonny had his own path to take. John Coltrane, you know, as we heard, really worked very hard to get a handle on Monk's music, but Coltrane had his own path to follow. Monk had excellent musicians around him all the time, but it was difficult music. And I should add, I also argue that it was difficult for Monk to play his music. Mm-hmm. there's a couple of really wonderful moments where he's giving a kind of lecture demonstration at the New School in 1963. And he's with this arranger composer named Hall Overton, who's like the host, the MC, and this someone he collaborated with. And at one point, Hall says, "Okay, Monk, play the song we just heard, Tinkle Tinkle." And so Monk plays it. In the very last part of it, he kind of misses a couple of notes. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Oh, I missed that one." And the audience laughs, you know, because it's very charming. And part of what it tells us is that, you know, Monk worked very hard just to achieve his own sound, which was so unlike even the great pianists around him. He could play like Art Tatum, who was considered like the greatest pianist in the jazz tradition, if he wanted to. But he chose something different.
Art Tatum had just one of the magical right hands that could fly up and down the keyboard.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And every once in a while, he'll show one of his friends or sidemen that he can do that if he wanted to, but he chose to take the difficult path.
You know, one of the things, we're talking to Robin Kelly, author of Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Although we're airing this program January 17th, we taped it shortly before going on air. Professor Kelly is in England most of the year. He's back in the United States, so we briefly got a hold of him for taping this program in late December. So don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking about Thelonious Monk, the subject of his new book, the musician who's been gracing our program for the last 8 years and hopefully for the next 8 years coming up. And the definitive biography of truly, as you put it in your subtitle, an American original. You know, one of the striking features of the book, too, that I really enjoyed was, you know, how much these weren't songs like pop songs we think of where there's like a melody and then you improvise off it. Like a jazz musician might take a Gershwin tune and then improvise off it, and other people have different improvisations. He was constantly mining his own music and reinterpreting it himself throughout his career. I mean, it seemed like, you know, there were countless versions of many of his songs that he himself did, right?
Absolutely. You know, his entire repertoire numbered less than 100 tunes compared to a writer like, you know, Duke Ellington or Horace Silver, who was writing thousands of tunes. So here we have a small repertoire, but he could play like 500 versions of Blue Monk, which is his blues. And each one sounds different. You know, he really pushed for that. He may play like Evidence or these kinds of songs, and what he would
do—which we'll listen to in a few minutes.
Yes, what he would do is not only make each improvised version its own work of art, but he also insisted that he and his sidemen use the melody to improvise, as opposed to playing, you know, whatever they feel like playing over the chords. Because for him, a song was a complete thing. And if you ever listen to Monk music, sometimes you'll have a saxophone player playing all kinds of stuff, and behind him, Monk will start playing the melody to remind the horn player, don't forget where the music is. You know, the music is in the melody. And so that's the other thing, is that to be able to reinterpret the melody in so many different ways, and you never get tired of it, it's pretty astounding.
And one last thing I want to talk about before we go on, but this is something that comes up in the book several times, and I think it's quite striking about Monk's music, which is how physical it is. You know, he'd be up at the piano singing along with it, pounding his feet, just physically moving with the music, oblivious to really anyone else almost, he's into it. And then in moments where he'd be playing with his band, or his group at a nightclub, sometimes when he would drop out and not be playing and the horns was soloing with the bass and drums, he would just get up and start dancing on stage. And you know, I think for a lot of jazz musicians, this would seem bizarre. I couldn't imagine Miles necessarily dancing around the stage. But for Monk, it makes perfect sense because the music has a sort of a physical quality to it.
Exactly. It has a physical quality. So he's dancing, as you pointed out, he's dancing at the piano itself. His feet are moving, his body's moving, and again, there's something old-fashioned about that, because Willie the Lion Smith, who was a great stride pianist, wrote in his memoir, he says, if a piano's not mumbling and grumbling, if you're not mumbling, you're not doing anything. You know, and so for Monk, mumbling is both verbal, but it is also physical. The other thing about Monk is that he grew up as a teenager, spent 2 years playing with an evangelist, with a faith healer, traveling across the country. And he saw people, you know, who were engaged in kind of ecstatic movements. And my take is part of what he reproduces on stage, in the clubs, at home, is a kind of those ecstatic movements, you know. And he also uses his dance as a way to conduct the band. When artists are not clear on tempo, on accents, he will give it to you with his body. And every musician I've ever talked to told me that.
One of the things you've talked about, Robin Kelly, already, it comes up in the book, it's a constant theme, is the notion of bebop and the bebop revolution and Monk's role in it. He's oftentimes characterized as, you know, one of the three great innovators that led to the bebop revolution, along with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. I think a lot of our listeners have heard the term bebop, don't exactly know what that means. And could just, what is bebop and what was Monk's role in the bebop revolution?
Sure. Bebop was an evolution or a break, depending on how you think about it, in jazz. And it emerges, you know, as a self-identified movement in the 1940s. The emphasis was on virtuosity. You know, you speed up the tempos. You play these really intricate lines. The harmonies are more dissonant than they were back in the days of swing music. It's not to say that it's dramatically different, but it's different enough. It's different enough for it to have its own marketing strategy to sell bebop. What Monk represented was, in some ways, he was like the harmonic mind. His ideas about harmony passed down to people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and others, who's a piano player himself. But Monk himself did not play bebop. He didn't. For him, the virtuosity didn't come through fast tempos. Mm-hmm. Monk always played medium to slow tempos. For Monk, you know, he wasn't interested in what beboppers were interested in. That is taking the old Tin Pan Alley songs and just writing new lines over them. And so Monk sort of went his own path. The sad thing is that when bebop became hot in the world of commercial jazz, Monk, in some respects, was excluded from that. He wasn't always invited to the important concerts. He wasn't always getting gigs. And these were like the darkest, most difficult times of his life, from the late 40s when he's making this great music all the way up until like the mid-50s. And I mean, there are other reasons for that, but part of it has to do with being outside the framework of what was considered bebop.
Let's talk a little bit about Monk's upbringing, where he was from, because, you know, he came very much, unlike some of the great jazz musicians of that era, he came very much from a working-class family, a New York City kid. And you did some research for the book on his family's background. What's his history?
Sure. He was born in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and his mother left her husband there, and traveled to New York, largely because Rocky Mount had no high school for children. I mean, the fact is that being black in the Jim Crow South is difficult to get an education. So she moved to New York to educate her children, and she had family there. They settled in a place called San Juan Hill, which is, if anyone knows New York, there's Lincoln Center, which is sort of the West 60s. And if you go further west toward the Hudson River, almost to the river, there's a bunch of projects there called the Amsterdam Houses. Well, on that space still exists a working-class community. And in those days, before the Amsterdam Houses were built, there was tenement houses. The black, mainly West Indian and African-American, Southern African-Americans, lived on the streets, 63rd, 64th, 62nd Street. And along the avenues were white working-class ethnic groups, Irish, Jews, Italians. And it was a very interesting community because in some ways it's racially mixed, but not mixed at all. Mm-hmm. It was characterized, it's called San Juan Hill because it had so many race riots there throughout the 20s and 30s. Monk grew up in a very close-knit community with a wonderful, vibrant community center called the Columbus Hill Community Center that had orchestras and bands for some of the black kids who lived there. Black professionals volunteered, and, you know, he also lived in a neighborhood full of musicians. Now, they were musicians by night, but by day a lot of them were, you know, shoeshine people that worked as custodians. And so Monk grew up in this rich musical world full of West Indian music, Caribbean music.
Yeah, let me stop you on that point, because Robin Kelly, one of the things that comes through in your book, not just in his early days, Monk's early days, but throughout the book, that I think would surprise a lot of readers and certainly got my attention, was the significant role the West Indians played in the African-American culture of the United States and jazz culture in New York City in this era, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting that a lot of the concerts in those days, community-based concerts, would have calypso bands and jazz bands playing together. And it wasn't unusual for jazz musicians to play calypso and vice versa. The other thing is that, you know, Monk couldn't walk down the street without hearing a Victrola or a radio playing like the music of the great Macbeth, who's a great calypsonian, or hearing even the Spanish Caribbean salsa and other kinds of music. It's everywhere. And you listen to songs like Monk's Dream, for example, it has that kind of Caribbean flavor, Spanish Caribbean flavor, mm-hmm. as well.
And or then so, there's Bemsha Swing, which
is... Yeah, Bemsha Swing's another one.
Phenomenal yeah. song.
Yeah, and in fact, the title itself refers to Barbados. It was the nickname for Barbados was Little Bemshire, you know. So it's there, deep in the music. And the last thing about that community is that Monk had training. He had piano teachers. He learned classical music from a man named Simon Wolfe, and he had a jazz piano teacher named Alberta Simmons, a black woman who has never really entered the annals of jazz history, but she was a very significant figure.
Our guest, Robin D.G. Kelly, author of the new book, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, published by Free Press. He's joining us today. We pre-recorded this program of Media Matters because Robin Kelly was in the United States briefly. He's spending the year in England as an academic. When he's back in the U.S., he's a professor at the University of Southern California. He's written numerous books on American history and politics and music, and he's written widely. It's a pleasure to have him on the show again. Since it is pre-recorded, don't call in. Let us do the talking today on Media Matters. We're going to go back and listen to another tune in a little bit, but I want to get back to the music for a second, because when reading this book, you really do a tour of, I wouldn't say all, but most of the great figures and less well-known figures, for that matter, in the whole development of American jazz in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And I was surprised to learn about the close relationship that Monk had and how tight-knit this community was in many respects. I'd like to have you talk about a few of the people, some of whom are extremely well-known, some not as well-known. First and foremost, someone you've mentioned already, Bud Powell, who I sense was almost Monk's best friend, at least in the musician community, and sort of the subject of one of Monk's greatest songs, In Walked Bud.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Bud Powell, who he was, his legacy, his relationship with Monk.
Right, Bud Powell grew up in Harlem. He and his one of his best friends, a man named Elmo Hope, another piano player, because they were like a trio. But Bud Powell and Elmo Hope came up together as kids in Harlem as being sort of the really outstanding classical pianist. I mean, he had classical training, and who also played jazz. And Bud's father was a musician as well, and his brother, Richie Powell. And so when Bud came on the scene, it was Monk who introduced him around and insisted that the club owners allow him to play. The irony, of course, is that soon Bud Powell's reputation surpassed Monk's, and Bud was recording some of Monk's music before Monk could record Monk's music. But nevertheless, they maintained a very close relationship. Bud Powell himself suffered from mental illness and had a very difficult time, but Monk was always there for him throughout up to his death, you know. They played very differently.
Yeah, I mean, Powell, just to, for listeners who haven't heard him, was an astonishing, I mean, he's the classic bebop pianist.
Absolutely.
An astonishing pianist, but a very different style.
Right, I mean, the classic bebop pianist is a great definition because for Powell, his right hand was important. Fast lines, very sparse left hand. So he was different from Monk, but when Bud Powell played Monk's music, he probably came the closest to bringing a Monkian interpretation to Monk's music. You know.
Well, let's talk for a second then also about someone else we've also talked about who's probably considered one of the gigantic figures of jazz, which is John Coltrane. And what was the nature of Coltrane's relationship with Monk?
They first met, I believe, about 1955-56. And Coltrane at the time was playing with Miles Davis. He's a wonderful alto, I mean, alto. He started out on alto, but he ended up playing tenor saxophone. And, you know, he was developing a reputation. He had some trouble with heroin. And when he decided to quit and Miles Davis eventually fired him because he was having a lot of trouble just maintaining, it was Monk who hired Coltrane and brought him into his band. In 1957 at the Five Spot. What's interesting about their relationship is that it was really a mentor-mentee relationship. Coltrane sometimes would come to Monk's house early in the morning. Nellie, his wife, Monk's rock wife, would make him breakfast and say, well, when Thelonious wakes up, you know, he could talk to him. Monk would get up, he'd give Coltrane some music, he'd say, practice that, he'd go back to sleep, get back up again, they work out the song, and he was doing that almost on a daily basis. And Coltrane really revered Monk for his knowledge of the music, and he learned so much from him as a saxophone player. And they made great music together.
Well, let's go back now to our next cut, which we want to play, Evidence. And we're going to join this midway through because it's a long cut, so we don't have time to play the whole thing. Robin, a little bit about Evidence.
Sure. Evidence was first recorded in 1948. It is, in some ways, a take on an old standard called Just You, Just Me. And what Monk basically does is he takes that melody and strips it down to just a few little sort of notes and creates a very abstract kind of painting. But it's a song that swings really hard. This particular recording is from Japan. In 1963, in May, the saxophone player is Charlie Rouse, the drummer is Frankie Dunlop, and the bass player is Butch Warren, who had just joined Monk's band. And what we're going to hear is probably just Monk's, the end of Charlie Rouse's solo, mostly Monk's solo.
And Charlie Rouse, for those who might be familiar with his name, was probably the most well-known sideman who played saxophone in the Monk Quartet for, what, almost a decade?
Yeah, actually almost 12 years, just under 12 years.
Okay, well, let's now go to Evidence. We'll join it midway.
Thank you.
No show would be complete without a drum solo. So I'm glad we got evidence.
What's so great about that drum solo is that for the discerning listeners, Frankie Dunlop basically played the song Just You, Just Me on the drums.
Hmm.
That's exactly what he did. And it's wonderful.
Our guest, Robin Kelly, you've just been listening to, author of the brand new book, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, the definitive biography of Monk, and not just the biography of Monk, but I think it's, if you're interested in jazz and American culture and American society in the middle third of the 20th century, this is an indispensable book to read. And one of the things, Robin Kelly, that occurred to me as I was reading the book was it reminded me of how jazz was very different in the 1950s, especially when Monk finally began to get the recognition that he deserved in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, being on the cover of Time magazine, that there was, jazz was very much sort of dynamic, cutting edge in a way that it has been lost since then.
Yeah, and I think that's true. At least it was dynamic and cutting edge in the sense that there were a lot of changes taking place in the 50s. The late 50s was a period of the emergence of the jazz avant-garde, for example. It was a period when Duke Ellington had international recognition. It was a period when people wanted to go back in time and recover the old swing bands. I mean, every genre of music, of jazz you could think of, existed side by side, but it was also, you know, important enough to be the center of debates in the New York Times and in the press, where writers really struggled over what is the direction of jazz. Is it going to be free jazz and really dissonant? Is it going to reflect the movement in the visual arts with abstract expressionism, or will it swing and embrace rock and roll? All these things are happening at the same time.
Yeah, I think that what got me, you know, he was on The Tonight Show, he was in the cover of Time magazine. It was sort of a sense in the culture that this was a guy and this was a movement that needed to be taken seriously by everyone. Mm-hmm. And in a sense that jazz is now plays a crucial role in our society still, but it's sort of nestled into a corner now.
Yeah, I think it's part of it's nestled into a corner. Part of it's been, as I say, museumized. But there's another part of jazz that doesn't get as much play, and that is a whole group of younger musicians who are trying to bring together jazz and hip-hop, improvisational music, electronic music, and not in the way that fusion emerged in the 1970s, but in something that's really fresh and new, but it doesn't get the kind of media attention that, say, Wynton Marsalis and Jazz at Lincoln Center might get, or repertory bands, you know. So in some ways, it's like the old adage, you know, jazz is dead, long live jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it lives underground.
One of the themes that comes out through the book that you periodically return to is Monk's periodic interest in politics or involvement with benefits of one kind or another. Not that it was an overwhelming theme, but the period of his life also was simultaneous with the great emergence of the civil rights and later black power movements. What was his relationship to the politics of his era, and maybe more broadly, the relationship of jazz to those politics?
Yeah, well, you know, just as you pointed out, I mean, jazz in the 50s was very dynamic, but so was the social movements, not just in the South, but the North, not to mention anti-colonial movements in Africa and Asia and Latin America. So jazz had a direct relationship to some of these movements. The Village Gate was a kind of, you know, beehive of political activity, and they also, you know, hosted a lot of jazz musicians. So they played benefits constantly for the March in Washington, for CORE, for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And Monk himself was always willing to play a benefit. He goes back to playing benefits for Paul Robeson to get his passport back in 1954.
And that was a period in which standing up for Paul Robeson was a fairly courageous move.
It sure was, yeah. I mean, it's the height of the Cold War, Robeson's persona non grata, and there's Monk playing for Robeson. But let me add one more thing about the benefits. When you actually quantify, you know, the benefits Monk was playing, you know, quite a few were for the civil rights movement, but a lot of them were very local, very community-based, whether it's the Morningside Community Center in Harlem or Sydenham Hospital in Harlem, the Bedford YMCA. Monk believed in community, and a lot of times it's the benefits that were closest to home that mattered most to him. And there's also a kind of irony is that as he struggled to support movements for social change, there are things in his own life that were collapsing and falling apart. I mean, imagine what it means to play a benefit for the March on Washington in August, and 2 weeks later your nephew dies of a heroin overdose. You know, his nephew named Ronnie Newkirk. Mm-hmm. That destroyed Monk. You know, I mean, in some ways, he was very active, but he also said, which is true, I got my own problems, you know.
You know, and I mean, you touched there, Rob and Kelly, on the issue of heroin, which is a recurring theme throughout the book. And I think the death of his nephew was sort of, I didn't see that coming, and so it really sort of encapsulated the sort of storyline of who's dealing with so many of his colleagues and friends are heroin addicts, and it takes over their lives. And throughout the book, you're seeing people dying at tragically young ages due to heroin overdoses.
Yeah, in fact, it's amazing how many chapters end with a death.
Mm-hmm.
It got to be depressing after a while. It is true, heroin ravaged the musicians' communities in certain parts of black communities in the Bronx and Harlem and Brooklyn. And it was something that, you know, Monk used a little bit, but he was never an addict, but he saw the devastation it had. And, you know, something we still have to come to terms with. The amazing thing about heroin, though, in New York is that the worst of it was really much later, the middle to late 60s, when it was no longer a musician's issue or a poor black male community issue. It became a national crisis, you know. And so it's definitely one of these issues that it's hard to avoid, you know, writing a book like this.
In the book, and we've only got a few minutes left, Rob and Kelly, and I think that one of the things you do in the book that I really like is you take this very complex man and leave him complex, but you also get a sense to try to get an understanding for him because, as you said at the top of the hour in the program, Monk is often presented as this sort of eccentric guy who's talking to himself and walking off in the woods like some mad genius. And instead, you know, he's actually a great family man and, you know, community oriented and people who knew him loved him. He's very sociable. So, but at the same time, one of the recurring themes that emerges in the book is that he was wrestling throughout his life and especially the last 10 or 15 years with fairly serious mental illness.
Yes, definitely. He suffered from bipolar disorder, which in those days wasn't diagnosed as such. And he was definitely committed to his family, to making a living. Part of his frustration was his inability to make a living for so long, especially after he was arrested and lost his cabaret card in 51, which wasn't restored until 57, so 6 years without working. The mental illness, I kind of argue, was exacerbated by poor medical treatment. He was given dosages of Thorazine, which didn't really help him. And then the Baroness's doctor, Dr. Robert Fryman, was giving him what he called vitamin shots. But the vitamin shots turned out to be amphetamine. It's like B12 laced with amphetamine. And so Thorazine is a kind of a depressant. Amphetamine is a sort of, you know, stimulant. And the combination of these things, along with drinking and whatever it is he did, made his condition worse. So it was a real struggle for him to get up and play as much as he played. And so part of the story of his unreliability, I argue, is overblown because, sure, he missed a few gigs, and sometimes he'd show up late. But when it came time to hit, as they say, he usually hit. In other words, he was on the bandstand playing despite a drug that made his hand stiff or feeling a little out of sorts, you know.
You know, Rob and Kelly, we've only got about a minute left, and I listened to an interview with Marion McPartland and another woman jazz pianist on NPR just a few weeks ago, interestingly enough, coincidentally, before I read your book. And Marion McPartland asked her, you know, what jazz composers do you most love to play? Who's your favorite composer? And she easily said, oh, of course, Monk. And McPartland said, of course. And it was striking to me, these two pianists were just like, you know, Monk was just at a different level in their pantheon. And after you've done all your work, where do you think Monk's legacy is as a musician, as an artist, compared to the other greats?
Well, I would place him along the pantheon of the greatest American composers, along with not just jazz, mm-hmm. but people like George Gershwin, you know, and John Cage and others. He also brought something different to the piano, and his compositions have become part of jazz repertoire. You know, I mean, everyone has to play them. If you can't play Monk, then you're not really engaging the tradition.
Rob and Kelly, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Rob
thank
and
you.
Kelly.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Rob and Kelly is the author of Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back with you in 1 week. And again, Rob and Kelly, good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, cloudy today with a high of 35 degrees. Tonight, cloudy with areas of fog and a low of 28. Monday, mostly cloudy with a high of 37 degrees, areas of fog in the morning. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low of 27. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high of 37. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.